Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The best scenario for real estate agents and mortgage lenders? High home prices. Who helps determine those prices? Appraisers. What happens when those parties have alleged side agreements? It's called the subprime meltdown, and they get sued. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at shrinersforkids.org. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday. It is the first day of November. So far, the main villains in the subprime story have been mortgage brokers, banks, and investors who blithely bought into risky mortgage securities. Today, a new character, courtesy of New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. He sued a real estate appraisal company called eAppraiseIt. The company allegedly colluded with Washington Mutual to inflate home values. Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports.
eAppraiseIt manages 20,000 home appraisers around the country. They're the people who put a value on your house when you take out a mortgage. Cuomo's suit says Washington Mutual, the biggest savings and loan in the country, pressured eAppraiseIt to find and use appraisers who would inflate home values. Terry Duncan is president of the Appraisal Institute. He represents a quarter of the 90,000 home appraisers in the U.S. He says banks often try to get appraisers to say a house is worth more than it is.
It is prevalent. Some would suggest even rampant. In those instances where the appraiser caves to that type of pressure, it does tend to create a spiraling up effect.
Bad appraisals weren't just fuel for the housing bubble. David Berenbaum is executive vice president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He's been working with states around the country to crack down on appraisal fraud. He says a bad appraisal can make it impossible for a subprime borrower to refinance.
This is critical. There's no question about it. Again, we see it again and again in the loans that we're intervening on now to prevent foreclosure and to do loan mods or refinances. We go back and we do forensic appraisals, and we see folks who have had problematic appraisal all too frequently.
Washington Mutual said today it's suspending its relationship with eAppraiseIt. Duncan and Berenbaum both say it's going to take more lawsuits and federal legislation for the industry to clean up its act. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Hollywood writers and the studios they work for finally yelled, cut, at the bargaining table last night. 12,000 members of the Writers Guild could walk off the job any moment now. The main sticking point is how writers will be compensated when their work appears somewhere other than the silver or TV screens. Without a deal, viewers can find themselves without new episodes of their favorite shows. And Marketplace's Sam Eaton tells us there could be a serious economic hit to a place that's called Tinseltown for a reason.
In 1988, the writers' union's five-month walkout cost Los Angeles $500 million in lost wages. Jack Kaiser with the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation says today that number would be in the billions. And that's not including the multiplier effect on thousands of other businesses and workers who depend on the industry.
Everything from equipment rental, construction supplies, you've got to build sets, caterers, limos, hotels, it would have a significant impact.
Kaiser says the entertainment industry is L.A. County's third largest employer, injecting some $30 billion a year into the economy. UCLA economist Jerry Nicholsberg says the strike's price tag will have everything to do with time.
The economic impact of the strike is going to depend crucially upon how long the strike is.
He says studios have been stockpiling material for months as a way to ride out a short strike.
So the individuals involved in that production still worked. They simply worked earlier and they worked longer hours.
That does little to change the impact on institutions like Arts Deli and Studio City. Owner Harold Ginsberg says the entertainment industry accounts for about 30% of his business.
As I was telling somebody, when we put the key in the door and close at night, you just, as a restaurateur, you hope that the next day when you open the door, people are going to come back in.
He says with a possible strike announcement tonight, that saying now takes on new meaning. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
While you were sleeping last night, the average price for gas in this country rose a cent and a half to $2.91 a gallon. But that's nothing when you consider that Chinese citizens awoke to a 10% hike in prices at the pump. Analysts say that, in turn, is one big reason world oil prices breached $96 a barrel today. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains the cause and effect.
China is already the world's second largest importer of foreign oil, and it's gaining fast on number one, the United States. To keep a lid on inflation, the Chinese government has shielded drivers from the rising cost of oil. Some analysts expect China's hike in fuel prices will eventually slow consumer demand and ease the upward pressure on global oil prices. But Donald Strassheim with Roth Capital Partners doubts it.
You could raise the price of gasoline by 50% in China, and the demand side wouldn't move a lick. Just like Americans, they want to work, earn, and consume. The automobile is an important part of their evolving economy. There is little chance that the demand for gasoline is going to slow anytime in the next decade.
As evidence, Strassheim points to the U.S., where $3 a gallon gasoline has made little dent in demand. Analyst John Kingston at the energy information company Platts says not only is China's growing appetite for oil driving the global price, it's swamping fuel efficiency gains in the U.S. and Europe.
It basically wipes out all the efforts that anybody who might be listening to this has taken by slowing down or changing their light bulbs. It's very good that you've done that, but by the same token, the Chinese have just eaten up your savings.
China imports nearly 4 million barrels of oil every day, and that's expected to double in 8 years. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, inflation worries and a downgrade of Citigroup helped push the Dow down 350 points. Details when we do the numbers. Imagine having access to a car any time of day for as long as you need it. It's called car sharing. People who don't want to own cars rent one by the hour and pay a membership fee. Our friends across the pond pioneered the idea. Here in the U.S., Boston and Seattle are among the cities getting in on the action. But starting today in Seattle, car sharing drivers will have to pay almost 10% in car rental taxes. Users call it a penalty on doing right by the environment. From Seattle, Kathy Ducham explains.
Car sharing is pitched as a way to wean people off automobiles, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A good thing, but not just a green thing.
We use these vehicles as kind of corporate cars. There's so many of them right downtown that we're able to get cars on pretty much a moment's notice.
That's Steve Orser, real estate developer. His company, Harbor Properties, has a corporate account with FlexCar. The private company buys cars same as rental companies do, then it leases parking spaces for those 350 cars all over Seattle. FlexCar rents them out for $10 an hour. Sitting behind the wheel of a Honda Hybrid, Orser says FlexCar beats out rental car companies on convenience.
I don't have to figure out where a Hertz might be or go out to the airport or even go downtown. Within a matter of minutes, I can be on the computer, reserving it, and then straight into the car and using it.
That kind of talk has generated envy and interest among traditional car rental firms, especially a few months ago when the companies found out that in Washington state, tax collectors had exempted FlexCar from a 9.7% car rental tax. Not fair, says Laura Bryant. She's spokeswoman for the parent company of Enterprise Alamo and National Car Rental.
I think trying to differentiate between, depending upon how long you actually rent a car, I think that that certainly is a very gray area, and you can see if you run it for 2 or 3 hours, it starts to be equivalent to running it for a day, and then what is the difference?
The Washington State Department of Revenue agreed. The tax break for FlexCar went bye-bye. The phone started to ring in the office of State Senator Jean Cole Wells.
Mainly I heard from my constituents that they didn't think it was fair that they pay more taxes. They're trying to do their part to reduce traffic congestion and not own a vehicle.
Cole Wells wants to reinstitute the tax break for car sharing, but it's tricky. You can't make a law that benefits just one company, and car rental companies want the tax break too. So what about repealing the tax altogether? Well, that would cost the state $33 million a year in lost revenue. FlexCar user Steve Orser is sticking with the service despite the new tax, though he wants a fix.
We're so aware about global warming, and we need to just cut down on single vehicle usage and gasoline usage altogether. Here's where the rubber meets the road, where we can get a chance to really do that, and I hope that the state follows through on that.
For its part, FlexCar sees the loss of the tax break as a speed bump. The company just announced it's merging with Boston-based Zipcar. That creates a car-sharing co-op that will span the nation. In Seattle, I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace.
You know those lists of hobbies, favorite movies, and bands on your online profile? They're fun to fill out, but they're even more fun for advertisers. Today and tomorrow, the Federal Trade Commission is examining the privacy issues raised by internet tracking technology. We mentioned yesterday that there's talk of a do not track service, similar to the do not call list. Commentator Catherine Montgomery says kids are especially vulnerable to digital marketing.
Teens are growing up in an immersive digital environment. On any given day, they're glued to their cell phones, sharing videos on YouTube, and hanging out on MySpace or Facebook. These new online social networks are becoming critical tools for adolescent development, encouraging kids to explore their identities, find their voices, reach out to peers, and even engage in politics. But as social networks begin to monetize their businesses, the forces of interactive marketing are rapidly transforming them into sophisticated data collection and ad targeting machines. Advertisers are practically salivating over the abundant psychographic and behavioral information that social networking sites can offer. In addition to basic demographics, marketers can glean a wealth of enormously rich data, including personal relationships, ethnicity, religion, political leanings, sexual orientation, or whether a person drinks or smokes. Dozens of new data miners and ad-serving companies have swooped in to nano-target and hypo-target individual users with personalized ads. Social networks are just one part of what advertisers see as an expanding digital marketing ecosystem. Today's teens are also being targeted on their cell phones, through instant messaging and in video games. Marketers are making it fun and easy for kids to create online commercials for brands, which are then distributed widely on the internet. Companies are crafting one-to-one messages designed to work at a subconscious level by tapping into an individual's innermost needs, desires, and anxieties. Most teens don't realize the extent to which they've become part of elaborate virtual focus groups. The internet is still relatively young. It would be a shame if we allowed the promise of the new digital media to be undermined by the unfettered growth of invasive marketing. Such trends could turn the online world into a surveillance society. The loss of privacy is too high a price for reaping the benefits of the digital age.
Catherine Montgomery is the author of a new book called Generation Digital. Send us your thoughts. We promise not to track them. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Coming up, hard work doesn't translate into hard currency in Burma.
The official exchange rate to the U.S. dollar is 6. The unofficial exchange rate is about 1,300.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street tumbled today with banks and retail companies leading the way. The Dow lost 362 points, 2.6%, to close at 13,567. The Nasdaq also dropped 2.25%, 64 points, to end at 2794. The S&P ended the day down 41 points, nearly 2.75% at 1508. Citigroup crumbled more than 6.75% after the company was downgraded by CIBC World Markets. Bank of America fell 5.33% after it was downgraded. Graded two. Target fell 4.7% on discouraging consumer spending news. Walmart lost more than 2.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 4.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Academy of Family Physicians, personal preventive care for better patient health, and reduced costs for business. AAFP.org/value. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a glance at events coming up Friday. Iraq's neighbors meet in Turkey to discuss security and stability in the region. The Energy Action Coalition sponsors a nationwide youth summit on climate change. And on this day, 87 years ago, Pittsburgh's KDKA went on air as the first commercial radio station. Programming that day included some music and the election returns of Warren Harding and James Cox. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. While some of us were sadly waving goodbye to the baseball season on Sunday, the Men's Ski World Cup kicked off in Austria. As of today, Bodie Miller is in fifth place overall, behind fellow American Ted Ligety. You'll notice I didn't say teammate. This is Miller's first competition since going solo after 10 years with the U.S. national team. So far, he's garnered $1 million in corporate sponsorships without them. Our Business of Sports commentator Diana Nyad is here to carve the powder with us. Hey, Diana.
Tess, what's going on?
Well, I was kind of hoping we could keep talking about the world champion Boston Red Sox, but I guess we're going to talk about skiing.
You are so warped in that particular area. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yep. On behalf of the team. But let's go ahead and talk about Bodie Miller. The guy is arguably the biggest personality in skiing, and part of that personality is the whole, hey, I'm an independent dude thing.
And is he ever?
In fact, he has gone completely independent from the team.
Yeah, he has dropped out of U.S. skiing. Now, that doesn't mean he can't compete in any event he wants, including the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. You know, you would think, well, you've got to be part of U.S. skiing if you're going to compete in the Olympic Games. But no, if he qualifies, he's an American. But, you know, what does he really do then for U.S. skiing, who's going out there trying to raise funds to develop the program, to, you know, get younger kids to come up and come through the program? You know what he's doing? Absolutely nothing.
Well, let me ask you, why does he owe U.S. skiing anything? I mean, most of us don't feel like we owe or should stay with the employers who helped launch our careers. We move on.
Yeah, but if you know, I think Michael Phelps in swimming might be the perfect example here. Okay, Michael Phelps years ago was a kid growing up, and yeah, he had talent, but mm-hmm. nobody knew, including him, that he was going to be the best swimmer in the world, touted as better than Mark Spitz. So U.S. swimming, as he was coming up through their developmental programs, sent Michael Phelps around the world with their training and traveling grants, made sure that he had plenty of gear of what he needed so that he could train and, you know, have the latest of technology. And now Michael Phelps is up to a little over $30 million a year in all of his particular individual contracts. So he doesn't, as Bodie Miller, he doesn't need U.S. swimming. As mm-hmm. Bodie says, he doesn't need U.S. skiing. He doesn't need travel money. He doesn't need coaching money. But he is the first one that shows up at the sponsors' tents at the Olympic Games, at the World Championships. championships, shakes everybody's hands, stands in the middle of the U.S. swimming team, gets his picture taken like, I'm part of this team, I'm part of U.S. swimming, U.S. swimming made me, so now I'm going to help them bring up the next generation. Whereas Bodie Miller says, who cares? I'm just not going to show up. I'm not going to help them at all.
I wonder if another example of this that just comes to my mind is golf, and we're seeing some of the top players, including Tiger Woods, back away from events like the FedEx Cup and tennis players routinely dropping out of big tournaments. But isn't that their prerogative? Is it their responsibility to prop up event sponsors and TV contracts?
Well, I think it, on the one hand, yes, they are individuals. It is their prerogative. Do we admire them, you know, as much for not dropping out? And I think the greatest example is one you're bringing up is the FedEx Cup. Mm-hmm. This was the inaugural year. They made it sort of the year-end, you know, sort of showcase event where they played four events, one after the other in September. And, you know, the big winner, who, of course, was Tiger, takes home all the big cash. And, you know, it was ill-conceived, and they'll probably really look at doing it differently next year, because if you had enough points, which Tiger did, to win without doing all four events, he had so many points that he could skip one.
And take the money. Yeah.
And take the money. Now, just as U.S. skiing, I called the people from U.S. skiing and I said, you know, come on, doesn't it hurt you that you can't market U.S. skiing with Bodie Miller? And they said, oh, no, we're doing just fine. We have all kinds of stars at skiing and we don't need Bodie Miller. And you know, just like in golf, if we could be a little fly on the wall, you know, they come out to the press conference and say, well, Tiger's not here this week, but that doesn't bother us at all. We've got all kinds of great personalities in the game of golf. It's going to be a wonderful weekend, you know, Tiger or not. Well, if we could be that little fly on the wall in their board meetings, they'd be going, oh, my God, what are we going to do? Well, you know, they pretty much feel the same about Bodie Miller, you know, wish they had him on the team.
Thanks, Diana.
Thank you.
Diana Nyad is our Business of Sports analyst. Burmese monks returned to the streets of Myanmar this week. It was the first march since the nation's ruling military opened fire on protesters last month. It's all part of the run-up to a visit this weekend by United Nations Special Envoy Ibrahim Gambari. But many Burmese are probably too busy trying to eke out a living to take much notice. Burma is Asia's economic basket case. It's also China's next-door neighbor. Marketplace's Scott Tong recently traveled to the border and witnessed a stark contrast between feast on one side and famine on the other.
Right now I'm standing on the China side of the Burmese border. There's a big hole in the fence, which is supposed to separate the countries. Now I just crossed over into Burma. And now I'm back into China. It's pretty porous.
Burmese natives are constantly trekking in and out of China, to do day labor, to buy everyday goods, to seek a better life. To them, China radiates like a high-definition color TV, while Burma trudges along in black and white. On the Burma side, 20-something Miss Duan works as a tour guide at this Buddhist temple. She says life isn't getting any better in one of the least developed countries on Earth. Most of the country's 50 million people are just eking out a life, she says. They don't have much time to ponder protests or military crackdowns.
It's always about the same here. In Burma, our farming sector is developed, but industry is completely undeveloped.
The Burmese don't make or export much, in part because of trade sanctions. So they import everything, from toothbrushes to toilet paper to cars.
We import Japanese cars. Chinese cars cannot handle the tough dirt roads here in Burma.
The average Burmese makes about $200 a year. Folks in China make eight times that. Wu Ye-won is a Burmese export broker.
It feels like the countries are opposite. China is moving forward so quickly, and Burma is going backwards.
The shoe used to be on the other foot. Early on in the 1900s, Burma was known as the Rice Bowl of Asia, rich in gemstones and agriculture and raw materials.
In the old days, Burma was far better than China. Chinese folks used to utter the word Burma and start drooling. Now it's flipped.
The ruling military has turned the country into Asia's economic backwater.
Ian Holliday of the University of Hong Kong says inflation, now 50%, renders Burma's currency increasingly worthless.
The official exchange rate to the U.S. dollar is 6. The unofficial exchange rate is about 1,300.
You know, get this. 10 years ago, Burma's top general made a bizarre currency decision. He introduced new bills, all multiples of 9. It was a lucky number, according to his astrologer. Holliday says the junta has made some conventional mistakes, too. They've not created reliable banking or tax systems or manufacturing capacity. That has been a big part of China's success across the creek. Beijing is Burma's biggest economic and military backer. And Holliday says China just can't understand why the Burmese generals are so inept.
China does feel the best solution for Burma is precisely the solution that was developed in China itself. That is, concede as little as possible on the political front and grow the economy underneath the authoritarian regime.
Holliday says the ruling junta is not just incompetent, it's corrupt. In fact, the nonprofit Transparency International just ranked Burma the most corrupt in the world. Here on the Chinese side of the border, folks say Burmese officials simply steal stuff from the people. This young man buys motorcycles in China, then smuggles them back into Burma to resell them, unless the bikes get confiscated.
If they're in a good mood, so just fine us a few dollars. But if they're in a bad mood, so take away our bikes.
This corruption and repression have created a sense of hopelessness that's prompted many people to get out of Burma. ...25-year-old Kim Dwe traveled across Burma for 3 days to escape to China. She now gives massages for 50 cents an hour.
The only way we could eat and feel full was to eat lots and lots of plain rice. We couldn't even consider eating chicken or fish. No way. But in China, I can afford lots of different food, whatever I want.
Her coworker Ma Juju left her husband and 4 sons back in Burma, back in a house with bamboo walls and dirt floors. She now shares a room in China above this massage parlor. 8 women sleep side by side on the floor, and to her, it's a big step up.
Every day in Rangoon, we scrape and scrape to make 75 cents so we could eat. And then we'll go to sleep and wake up and start scraping all over again.
She hopes her family can someday join her in China, a place that she describes as the promised land. On the border between Burma and China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, the 7th book in the Harry Potter series came out this past July. 8.3 million copies sold in 24 hours. No surprise, the final episode left fans clamoring for more. Well, author J.K. Rowling has indeed penned a follow-up titled The Tales of Beedle the Bard. But oh, mere muggles, only one of you will have the chance to own it. Rowling hand-wrote only 7 copies. 6 of them went to friends. The last will be auctioned off for charity in December. The starting bid is £30,000, about $60,000. For you Potterphiles, that's 12,444 galleons. For Sickles, 21 Knuts. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow plummeted 362 points, 2.6%. The Nasdaq fell 64 points, 2.25%. The S&P lost 41 points, nearly 2.75%. Our editors include Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, check out this new job title, Video Game Archivist.
Well, I asked my husband, who is a big gamer, what he thought, and his reaction was, oh my goodness, you have the coolest job in the world.
No, I do. I'm Tess Vigeland. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.